St. Irenaeus, an early church father, wrote, "The glory of God is a human being fully alive." If you've ever been to a sporting event, professional or non-professional, I've been to a sporting event. Okay, a lot of you, yeah. You've seen people cheering, jumping up and down, high-fiving, and perfect strangers even hug each other. I've been part of that. When I went to a Cleveland Browns game and they actually scored a touchdown, we went crazy. We're like hugging each other and jumping up and down, and then you usually know the end. We leave crying because they lost, and so that's how it is. But sports fans go absolutely crazy at games. We cry when we lose. I was actually watching the Kentucky-Indiana game last night, the basketball game, and at the end when Kentucky lost, they showed some fans, and this one girl was actually crying, and I was laughing, because I was like, that's so pathetic, but it's funny. So we cry when we lose, and I'm a Cleveland Browns fan, so I've done a lot of that. We cheer when we win, and I haven't done a lot of that, and nobody thinks this is anything but normal, right? People say, there's a fan. That's a true fan. If you've been a Cleveland Browns fan as long as I have been, you will say, you are a true fan, because we don't do a whole lot of winning. But what if we went to most churches and did any of that? They'd say, there's a fanatic. That person's a fanatic. You see, passion is a big deal in America. Hollywood movies, every soap opera, and thousands of books promote it. Passion is also all over the internet. If you Google on the internet, if you Google passion, you can easily find articles, magazines, and books with titles like A Passion for Alligators, A Passion for Artichokes, A Passion for Fly Fishing, A Passion for Birds, A Passion for Castles, A Passion for Chocolate, A Passion for Gardening. And if you feel especially passionate, you can also purchase what must be a number one bestseller book among sauna enthusiasts, A Passion for Steam. It's almost as if we think it's appropriate to get excited, be enthusiastic, have passion for anything in life, as long as it's not God. And we often are passionate about everything except God. Jesus was crystal clear about living with passion. A man walked up to Jesus one day and said, in essence, hey, I'm busy. I don't have time to read the book, and I missed the movie when it came out. Can you give me the Cliff Notes version of the Bible? Is there a point to this whole thing? And Jesus said, absolutely. Here is a summary of the entire Bible. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. This is the first commandment. And the second like it is this: you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these. Feel the passion in Jesus' words? The repeating word is all. Jesus' summary was crystal clear. He was saying, we are to love God, serve God, pursue God, and love, serve, and pursue people with passion. You are to give it all you have. No half-hearted commitment. This is the greatest spiritual problem in the Bible. Here's a question. What is the greatest sin in the Bible? Some Christians think the greatest sin is being a Democrat. Others think it's being a Republican. And I'll take it even one step further. Some believe it's being a Trump supporter, while others will believe it's being a Clinton supporter. Some Christians think the greatest sinners are Michigan fans, and that may be truly well. That may be true. That one may be true. Some think that getting drunk is the worst sin, or some might say adultery. For others, it's gossip. Still others say it's going to church in shorts. None of that. That's where I draw the line. Going to church in shorts. The list is endless. However, I believe the greatest sin is listed in Revelation chapter 3, verse 16. When Jesus said he'd rather you be hot or cold or hot than lukewarm. So because you are lukewarm, neither hot nor cold, I am about to spit you out of my mouth. C.S. Lewis wrote, "The only thing Christianity cannot be is moderately important. It's either ridiculous or it's the most important thing in the world." The greatest sin is being disinterested in God and apathetic about His Word. When you look at people who have had the most impact in the world, they were almost never the smartest, wealthiest, best educated, or most beautiful, but they did have one thing in common. They were people of passion. People of passion. Passionate people are world changers. Think of Mother Teresa, Martin Luther King Jr., Billy Graham, Apostle Paul, King David. These are all passionate people. They said, "There are things that matter, and I want to make my life count. And I'm not going to waste my life on trivial things." Here's the thing. Nothing great is done without passion. Nothing great is done without passion. Passion is what drives scientists to find new cures to dreaded diseases. Passion is what motivates people to live for great causes. Passion is what equips athletes to break records and get to the Olympics. Passion is what sustains you in reaching your goals as you go through life. Passion is what drives churches in reaching out to the lost and hurting people in their communities. Passion energizes life. It's what makes you alive. Without passion, your life becomes dull, drab, boring, and routine. The problem is that passion is easy to lose. I want to give you a universal equation this morning. Universal equation. New equals passion. New equals passion. All new car owners are fired up, right? If you've gotten a new car, you've been fired up before, right? Nobody else can drive that car. It's washed every 30 minutes, right? That lasts for a while. All new parents are fired up. All conversations are focused on the new baby. Pictures are taken every second. Then the third and fourth kids come along and they wonder why there are no pictures of them. And that's our life to a T. Like, we used to shoot pictures of Riley all the time. Now it's like, Oakley who? What? We were supposed to take pictures of him? Oh. But it's the same. All new marriages are fired up. While they are dating, guys ran around to open the car doors. And after they're married, they're looking at their wives saying, "What's wrong with your arm? Your arm broke? You can't open the car door yourself? What's going on?" Romance becomes routine. Everything new is fired up. New restaurants are packed. New iPhones sell out. People wait in long lines to see new movies, right? All new Christians start out this way too. You get passionate when you first learn the great truths of the good news. You get passionate when you first learn that every sin you've ever committed has been totally and completely wiped away, obliterated for all eternity. You get passionate when you first learn that God made you for a purpose, that there is a deep meaning and significance to your life. You get passionate when you first learn that God has promised you a place called heaven that's perfect. He's prepared it for you because you've committed your life to Christ, and one day you're going to spend eternity with Him in that perfect place. You get passionate when you first learn those things, am I right? I mean, you get passionate about that. You want to tell everybody. And then you run out of gas. Enjoying God is replaced with enduring life. Paul warned us about losing passion with this plea in Romans chapter 12, verse 11. "Never be lacking in zeal, but keep your spiritual fervor serving the Lord." The key word here is keep. That's the key word. If you're following along your Bible, circle that word. Keep. That means it's not automatic. And when there is no spark, no vision, no excitement, no faith, no enthusiasm, no willingness to risk. It affects your marriage, your emotions, your church, and even your spirituality. The good news is this. If you can lose it, you can recapture it. Some of you need to get your fire back. Some of you need to get your hopes back up. Some of you need to catch a fresh vision from God for your future. Some of you are in danger of wasting the one life you get to live without ever catching fire and fully living. It's my prayer that we would recapture your passion of God, or maybe even find it for the very first time this morning. This morning I want to share with you six ways Jesus taught us to keep the fire alive, or we can actually call this how to avoid becoming an old, cranky, boring, uptight grown-up. That's, you want to write that down too, behind under, you know, you say that too. So the first thing Jesus teaches us in order to keep the fire alive is this. Number one, Jesus knows you're better off young. Jesus knows you're better off young. But here's the thing, cemeteries are full of people who are dead serious about life. Jesus said these shocking words to the old, respectable, rule-keeping, tradition-keeping, religious elites of the day. Unless you become like little children. It's true, the Bible calls us to grow up and to mature. And it teaches there is more to life than having fun. But maybe we have lost something in the process that God never intended for us to lose. Maybe what we've lost was signaled at that very first Christmas. The surprising message of Christmas is God has become a baby. That erases every misconception anyone has ever had about God. Each year at Christmas, we discover how young God is. In his book, Orthodoxy, published in 1908, G.K. Chesterton wrote this, "Because children have abounding vitality, because they are in spirit fierce and free, therefore they want things repeated and unchanged. They always say, do it again. And the grown-up person does it again until he is nearly dead. For grown-up people are not strong enough to exult in monotony. It is possible that God says every morning, do it again to the sun. And every evening, do it again to the moon." Chesterton is hitting that maybe the sun doesn't just come up every day. God might be commanding it every single day. And the next morning he says, yesterday was great. Let's see it again. Encore. Maybe it's not automatic. Maybe God never gets tired of sunrises or sunsets. Chesterton went on, it may not be automatic necessity that makes all daisies alike. It may be that God makes every daisy separately, but has never got tired of making them. It may be that he has the eternal appetite of infancy. Chesterton summed it up in the best one-liner. For we have sinned and grown old, and our Father is younger than we. For we have sinned and grown old, and our Father is younger than we. That's what is communicated at Christmas. That's what is signaled in the words of Isaiah. For to us a child is born. We always assume God is older than we are, grouchier than we are, more uptight than we are. But when we really read the Bible, we discover that we are the ones who have sinned and grown old. We discover that God is younger than we are. He is more playful than we are. He is more alive and creative than we are. He is more full of life and zest than we are. We discover that we are the old, grouchy ones, and God is the young, delightful one. That is the exact opposite of what most people believe about God and most Christians believe about spirituality. The birth of a baby shook up the religious world. Maybe it ought to happen again. Rather than somebody becoming a Christian and then becoming more religious and uptight and judgmental and opinionated and harsh, maybe it's time to reconnect with Jesus, who said, unless you become like little children. Number two, Jesus knows you're better off dead. Jesus knows you're better off dead. Clavius, in our movie, a Roman tribune, had the goal to live a life for himself. Jesus made outrageous statements like these: for whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will find it. Or what good is it? What good is it for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? Or this one: whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross daily and follow me. Jesus is saying, you're better off dead. This is a strange recruitment campaign, right? It's a pretty strange recruitment campaign. I mean, today's marketing gurus would laugh at promising death to get people to join. But today's terrorists don't. They've hijacked a page out of our playbook. The problem is, it's our playbook. We just don't follow it. Today, a cross is a piece of jewelry. We forget that it was an instrument of torture and death. At the time of Christ, there were days when there were more than 500 Israelites who were crucified each day. They were publicly displayed where people would have to walk. And scholars have suggested that when Jesus said, take up your cross, he could have been standing near one of those crosses, maybe even looking at it. And everyone knew what he meant. Be ready to die. A life of following Jesus is built on a foundation of dying to self. The issue comes down to this: if I will not die to myself, I can't follow Jesus. It's not that he won't let me follow him. There is a can't of permission, which is, you can't do this because I won't let you. And then there's a can't of impossibility, which is, you can't do this because it's impossible. For example, training to compete in the Olympics on an all-Twinkie diet, that's my kind of diet, but training to be in the Olympics on an all-Twinkie diet will make your chances of being on the team impossible. Probably why I've never been in the Olympics. The can't of impossibility in following Jesus is this: whatever I'm refusing to die to will make authentically following Jesus impossible. Whatever I'm refusing to die to will make authentically following Jesus impossible. You will never make it if you try to follow two different masters. You're better off being obedient. The amazing paradox is this: dying to self looks like it leads to a life of emptiness and loss. In reality, dying to self leads to a life of joy and freedom. Why? Dead people aren't stressed. Dead people don't steal. Dead people aren't enslaved by addictive behavior. Dead people aren't weighed down by worry. Dead people don't abandon wives and kids for a younger spouse. Dead people don't judge, criticize, or condemn. Dead people are never jealous. Dead people are able to say no to temptation. Somehow, dying to sin makes me more, not less, alive. Die to yourself and you'll never be more alive. We're far better off dead. Number three, Jesus knows you're better off dependent. Jesus knows you're better off dependent. The disciples didn't have the answers, but they were dependent on following Jesus to figure it out. When I stop depending on God, I start depending on me, which ultimately leads to stress, worry, anxiety, regret, and frustration. Passion is replaced by pressure and panic. Too often in life, Christians think that they're to figure it all out, have all the answers, and then when things don't work out the way they planned, and then turn to God. Shouldn't we be dependent on God from the beginning? Shouldn't we be dependent on God in every aspect of our lives, including our finances? I mean, it's His anyways, right? Jesus said in John chapter 15, verse 5, apart from me, you can do nothing. Everyone say nothing.
Nothing.
Say it again, louder.
Nothing.
Nothing. Nothing. Apart from me, you'll be able to do a lot of smaller stuff, and then come to me and I'll handle the bigger things. Apart from me, you can do nothing. You are better off dependent. God is alive and He proves it every day. Number four, Jesus knows you're better off connected. Jesus knows you're better off connected. Let me ask you a passion-defining question. And here it is. Has there ever been a time in your life when you were closer to God than you are right now? Wow. That's a question that hits right in the heart. Has there ever been a time in your life when you were closer to God than you are right now? If the answer is yes, what happened? These are the things you need to ask yourself. Why don't I feel the passion I used to? Why don't I feel the same excitement about my career that I used to? Why don't I still feel the same enthusiasm about my marriage that I used to? Why aren't I as close to you and on fire for God as I used to be? Why does my relationship with Jesus feel so stale, so distant, or cold? What keeps me from being spiritually on fire for God? Why does so much of my life lack any sense of urgency? We lack all of this usually because we've lost connection. Untended fires soon become nothing more than piles of ashes. And for a lot of Christians, we become piles of ashes. Now, I haven't told many people this story. There's not a lot of people that know this story. And so very few people know the story I'm going to tell you until now. Back when I was fairly new into the ministry, and because some of the amazing connections that I had, I was actually part of a group of people who all received an invitation to meet the President of the United States in the Oval Office. I was thrilled. But the protocol was unbelievable. They sent letters, the FBI contacted me. It was really something. It finally came down to one final question I had, which was, what am I supposed to wear? The answer was, just wear what you normally wear to church. And my wife said, that's not going to happen. So I had to go out and get a suit and tie and make airline reservations. I flew to D.C. and checked into the closest hotel to the White House on the night before. My friend said to meet him at the front gates at 6:30 a.m. with my identification and be ready, be prepared that it might take quite a while to get through security and get in. You'd all check in. I was so excited, I couldn't sleep. I closed the heavy drapes on my window in my room and set the alarm on my iPhone for 6 a.m. and went to sleep. I finally got to sleep. And the next morning, my room was pitch black when I woke up. And my hotel room phone was ringing. And my friend said, hey, where are you? still waking up. Just waking up. Why aren't you here? I said, what's the problem? My alarm hasn't even gone off yet. You were supposed to be here at 6:30. He said, it's 6:30 now. And I looked at my phone and it was dead. And the clock in the hotel room, it said 6:30. He was right. I said, I can be there in 10 minutes. I'll run across the street. And he said, I'm really sorry, you've missed your chance. It slowly dawned on me, I've just slept through my one chance to meet the President of the United States in the Oval Office. I sat in bed stunned. Now let me tell you two things about that story. One, it's not true. It never happened. I never received an invitation to meet the President, although that would be really cool and I would be devastated if I missed it. But two, here's the second thing. Two, this same scenario happens to Christians all the time. Every day, every morning, we have the opportunity to meet with somebody far more important than the President of the United States. And a lot of time, we sleep right through it. The God of the universe has invited us to get up, to read his word, to pray, and to connect with him. We actually get to connect with the President of the universe. But many of us sleep through it every morning. No wonder we're so distant, disconnected, dissatisfied, and joyless. God, the actual God of the universe, longs to be close to you. You are as close to God as you want to be. Number five, Jesus knows you're better off focused. Jesus knows you're better off focused. The only people I know who have sustainable, positive, long-term joy and passion are all people with one thing in common. They believe God has amazing plans for tomorrow. Why? Future focus creates passion. Future focus creates passion. That leads to a very critical question. Do I have any future dreams? Do I have any future dreams? I love being around people who have expectations for their future. They believe God is alive. The resurrection really happened. God is still going to work, and is going to go to work even still tomorrow. A psychologist once said, what a person believes about their future is more important than anything that has happened in their past or anything that is happening in their present. Whit Hobbs wrote this. He said, passion is waking up in the morning wherever you are, however old or young, and bounding out of bed because you know there's something out there that you love to do, that you believe in, that you're good at. Something that's bigger than you are, and you can hardly wait to get at it again. It's something you'd rather be doing more than anything else in the whole world. You wouldn't give it up for money. It means more to you than money. And hopefully it's something that makes the world a better place. Number six, last one. Jesus knows you're better off missional. Jesus knows you're better off missional. Never have people had more comforts than in life than where we live now in America. Americans should be the happiest people in history, yet the suicide rate is skyrocketing. Suicide amongst teens is now the second leading cause of death. Sales of antidepressant drugs have gone through the roof. Why? Because people have everything except purpose. People with no purpose will have no passion, because passion and purpose go together. Passion actually creates purpose. Whether they realize it or not, everyone gives their life away for something. Some people give their lives away for their career, and 40 years later, they get a gold watch. Big deal. Some people give their lives away to get a big bank account. Some people give their whole lives to get some kind of pleasure out of life. Some people give their whole lives to attain some status. The real question is this: am I living for a compelling purpose? Am I living for a compelling purpose? The problem is that many people are giving first-class allegiance to second-class causes. Giving first-class allegiance to second-class causes. How much is this going to matter in eternity? How much is this going to matter forever? When you die, is it going to matter at all? You're going to give your life for something. The question is, are you going to give your life for something that actually matters? The great thing about people who live with purpose, who are connected and have future dreams, is that their passion overcomes any obstacle. Max Lucado told a story that illustrates this brilliantly. Says this: I have everything I need for joy, Robert Reed said. His hands are twisted and his feet are useless. He can't bathe himself, he can't feed himself, he can't brush his teeth, comb his hair, or put on his underwear. His shirts are held together by strips of Velcro. His speech drags like a worn-out audio cassette. Robert has cerebral palsy. This disease keeps him from driving a car, riding a bike, and going for a walk. But it didn't keep him from graduating from high school or attending Abilene Christian University, from which he graduated with a degree in Latin. Having cerebral palsy didn't keep him from teaching at a St. Louis junior college or from venturing overseas on 5 mission trips. And Robert's disease didn't prevent him from becoming a missionary in Portugal. He moved to Lisbon alone in 1972. There he rented a hotel room and began studying Portuguese. He found a restaurant owner who would feed him after the rush hour and a tutor who would instruct him in the language. Then he stationed himself daily in the park where he distributed brochures about Christ. Within 6 years, he led 70 people to the Lord, one of whom became his wife, Rosa. Max Lucado went on to say, he said, I heard Robert speaking recently. I watched other men carrying him in his wheelchair onto the platform. I watched them lay a Bible in his lap. I watched his stiff fingers open the pages. And I watched people in the audience wipe away tears of admiration from their faces. Robert could have asked for sympathy or pity, but he did just the opposite. He held his bent hand in the air and boasted, I have everything I need for joy. His shirts are held together by Velcro, but his life is held together by joy. One of my favorite quotes from author and speaker Reggie McNeil is this: it's not the church that has a mission. It's the mission that has a church. Everybody is trying to figure out how to live longer. That's not the real issue. It's not how long you live that matters. It's what you live for that matters. It's not the years in your life. It's the life in your years. Father God, we just thank you for the opportunity to walk through this movie, Risen, as we walk towards and through this week of Holy Week, Father, as we read the stories of how you came in riding on a donkey with everybody throwing palm branches at your feet saying, save us, save us. And that's what you were going to do, but not how they wanted. And a short week later, those same people who were saying, save us, save us, were yelling, crucify him, crucify him, because you didn't meet their expectations. Father, sometimes in life we are exactly those same people. We pray to you, we worship you, we ask you to do things in our lives, and when you don't do it, it's like we turn our back on you and say, crucify him. Father, when our expectations don't meet up to your plans, help us to realize that you have a greater plan. Help us to live with a childlike faith, with excitement and joy. And help us realize that you've put us here for a purpose. And that purpose isn't here to come here and gather every Sunday and just do things how we've always done them and just continue to feed ourselves. No, our purpose is to reach this community for you. These people who are dying every day and going to hell because they don't know or have a relationship with you. Father, you've called us to so much more. Help us to realize that. Help us to ignite fires within our souls again, Father, so that they don't burn out and we become a pile of ash, useless. Reignite our souls.